welcome to Business Watch. Good to be back with you after last week's break. And a day after celebrating the Fed signal that it wouldn't be making any big moves, traders woke up overnight deciding that the central bank will struggle to fight high inflation amid the lingering threat of a recession. And in a sharp about-face, investors sold stocks, bonds and cryptocurrencies late into Thursday. The S&P 500 losing 3.6%, erasing about $1.3 trillion US of market value, and the tech-heavy NASDAQ 100 dropping 5.1%, the most since September of 2020. Meanwhile, the Dow fell 3.1%. And the positive sentiment melted too after the BOE raised its rate for the fourth straight meeting, taking its benchmark to the highest in 13 years. And this week, we've also seen Zondo's fourth report into state capture and the NPA's victory in its battle to take on state capture corruption by overturning a Gauteng High Court ruling that unfroze R1 billion in assets allegedly linked to the looting of Transnet, certainly raised fresh hope on the accountability front, while watching the ANC debate how to fix Eskom in Parliament reminds one that the only power change the ruling party should be allowed near is at the ballot box. Well, let's welcome the panel. Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, Raymond Parsons, a professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Izam Klunga, chief economist at Alex Forbes. Warwick, that was probably the shortest relief rally in history. Is the market now saying it's unconvinced that the Fed will be able to engineer a soft landing?
Michael, I think one needs to be sort of quite careful of markets making yes-no answers to involved questions. I think the key issue here is that there's an appreciation now that certainly engineering any kind of half-decent landing is going to contain quite a lot of risk in it, which means that while the Fed could get it right, they could also get it very wrong. And we've spoken, I think, to some degree about the whole issue of policy error, which is always present at these sort of cycle times before. Now, I mean, obviously, with inflation running where it is, and let's say it stabilizes at 3 to 4%, I mean, there's quite a long passage between rates coming from where they were and are to matching up that prospective future inflation rate. So, I mean, we don't know where inflation is going to stabilize, and we don't know how hard the Fed is going to have to hike to actually rein in animal spirits. And of course, there's the question of, well, how much is cyclical cost push and how much is systemic inflation? All of these are risks, and all of these have to get priced in, and the process of pricing in inevitably puts pressure on share prices. So, that's a long answer to a fairly short question.
And I want to put some of those to Isa shortly. But before we move on, Warwick, the sign-off payout scenario, debacle, call it what you will. What's happening there? Because you've got these market purchase claimants and they're applying for refunds, the likes of collective investment schemes, individual shareholders. But apparently it's about as clear as mud as to how to go about things. More hoops than a three-ring circus, it would seem.
It's certainly quite a difficult process. In fact, I think a lot of stockbrokers who've got experience in this kind of thing have actually found it quite a struggle. I mean, with enough patience and a bit of experience and so on, and all the right box ticked, you can get it done. But I think what is quite aggravating here is that in the process, the administrators have effectively said, well, each individual client must do their own. They've effectively cut out the people who best positioned to assist with these claims and ensure that they are correct and work well. So instead of saying, well, your stockbroker can submit it for you, unless, of course, there's a massively long power of attorney and assorted others signed, and a lot of extra forms and boxes to check and so on. There seems to be a certain amount of failure that's going to be embedded in these claims, probably needlessly.
And one has to ask who stands to benefit, as always, when these things tend to arise. You've just got to follow the money. Now, Isa, turning to rates and inflation in the US and back to that conversation here, the Fed has raised its policy rate to 1% from 0.75%. If you look at inflation at 8.5%, it still means that real rates are deeply negative and still a long way to that sort of neutral or non-stimulatory rate. It really is a big question here as to how far behind the curve the Fed is, or is the Fed just saying that, you know, a lot of this inflationary pressure is due to what we're seeing on the supply side, and it will naturally right itself once we see those COVID issues and the war in Ukraine sort itself out? Where do you stand?
Look, what is very clear is that the Fed is behind the curve. They've waited too long to respond to rising inflation. Now they have to do catch up, which is why the expectations that markets hold were for 350 basis point hikes, inclusive of the one that we had this week, which means we still have two more to go. And over and above that, we still have 525 basis point hikes by the end of March 2023. That is one of the most aggressive hiking cycles that we have seen, perhaps even since the early 2000s. And yes, if you look from a inflation dynamics point of view, it's not just supply side. Remember, we have U.S. unemployment rate less than 4%. And historically, every time we have U.S. unemployment rate less than 4%, we've had significant demand pull inflation, which is what we are seeing now. In addition to that, the fiscal stimulus checks that were sent to every American had also stimulated demand. So it's not just a supply side story, it's also a demand side story, which means inflation is much more generalized than what we would want to believe, and we have to see the Fed continue to hike. I think what is also important is to notice this. Inflation impacts everybody, whether poor or rich. Unemployment is a segment of the economy, which means they would have to respond much more aggressively to inflation than they would to respond to high unemployment.
And it also creates expectations, doesn't it? When you think prices are going to rise that dramatically into the future, it brings that consumption forward, and that sort of feeds that inflation boogeyman. Raymond, just to bring you in here, and obviously now turning to inflation locally, and before we do that, happy birthday, and thank you for your extended national service. I think the country and we certainly owe you a debt, so congratulations on that. But the inflation picture locally, there does seem to be emerging divergence. There was a Moody's report saying it expects inflation to be at over 8% locally, while I read an Investec report this week saying contained within the upper range of that 3-6% band. What are the forces at play here that you see moving the inflation needle in South Africa?
Hi, Michael. Thank you for your good wishes. Look, I think just to build on what Isa said, that the punch bowl should have been taken away in the United States much sooner. In South Africa, there isn't a punch bowl to take away. So we're dealing with a somewhat different situation. We're still dealing with inflation, the impact of inflation, and it's quite clear that if you look at the trends in the production price index, you will see that for the past couple of months, it's been over 10-11%. This will feed through, and I think it was APSO who said this week they thought that it would show up in the CPI perhaps 6.2 or 6.3%. I'm not sure whether we're ready to talk about an 8% outcome here. But whatever one might say, it's clear that at its next meeting, the Monetary Policy Committee will have to act. Its own credibility is on the line. It has an inflation target, which is then being exceeded. So it will then have to take certain steps, which has already been hinted at, because we're in an interest-raising cycle at the moment. I think the big question for South Africa is, how rapidly do you do this? What are the cross-currents in the South African economy, which you do not have in the United States economy? I mean, I hear it's being said that unemployment is 3 or 4%. Gosh, I would like to have that problem in South Africa. That's the problem we have to manage rather than where we are. So what I'm saying is what we would have to do in the next couple of months, and what I think obviously the Monetary Policy Committee will have to do is to look at what is the trend in core inflation and what is the trend in wage inflation. Those are important variables which will decide the pace at which it can react. Remember, we started a lot earlier with our interest rate cycle, so we're in a better position. Our inflation is not quite as bad, but it seems to me that the cardinal question, given our economic prospects, which are constantly being trimmed for all sorts of internal reasons as well as external reasons, we've then got to say to ourselves, well, how far and how fast can we go as South Africa, given the trade-offs, not of the United States, but of South Africa? So that would be the curve, for me, would be the core decision, the pace at which we increase interest rates in South Africa in order to deal with an inflation which is primarily a source of supply shocks rather than demand pull. And that's the big difference between us and the United States. And that means how you respond monetarily has to be nuanced along those lines. But the fact that you will have to adjust interest rates, I think that's inevitable, and that's a reality test that all business people will now have to apply when they assess how will their borrowing costs rise over the next few months.
So it's a question of rising, but by how much? So without that demand pull inflation present here in South Africa, Isa, if you were a member of the MPC, how would you be voting on the 19th of May? More or less?
I will be voting for a 50 basis point increase. So essentially front load the interest rates hikes while growth is still decent, so that we don't have to do a lot more when growth significantly slows down because of global factors, but in addition, our own local factors such as load shedding that we have, which will continue to drag economic growth lower.
Warwick, which way would you go?
I think I'd go 25 because the economy is so soft, but I would be sure to rattle my saber very, very loudly indeed, making sure that the inference does a certain amount of work as well as the actual hike.
Raymond?
I would simply say I wish I was not a member of the MPC last week because it's a tough decision. I would simply say this, that what the Reserve Bank has to understand, that whatever it decides, it must not now act to precipitate stagflation, because it will be blamed if we end up in a stagflation. And those risks, both globally and domestically, are higher than they were before. And in South Africa's case, particularly so, because of the fact that our growth performance, we keep trimming it, yeah, but we keep wanting to put up interest rates. Yeah, so there's a credibility issue here too. But the important point is, do not act in such a way that you end up being blamed for an outcome that could be extremely negative. So I would pace it very carefully and understand there are cross currents. And because there are cross currents, there's uncertainty. And because there's uncertainty, you must not be mechanistic in your response and how to deal with inflation.
Well, a point well taken, Raymond, but just because it's your birthday, I'm not going to let you off that easily. Come, we've had 50 basis points, 25 basis points. Put a number on it.
Put a number on. Well, I think step by step, go for 25 to start with. And you can certainly crank up the rhetoric. Because you are data dependent. You will have to look at the core inflation, the wage inflation, and so forth. But I'm saying, given the cross currents, not only globally, but also in South Africa, I would tend to be cautious and go for 25 basis points. You will be revisiting it all in 2 months' time again.
As we turn our attention now to the first in-person mining indaba in more than 2 years, which takes place in Cape Town, as it always does at the Cape Town International Convention Centre. I think much has changed since the last meeting in February of 2020, ranging from commodity prices to electricity challenges and decarbonising or greening the economy. Warwick, does South Africa have a good story to tell investors at this time in the commodity space?
Michael, I'm sure that our story as a whole is probably quite insipid. Look, I mean, if you've got good enough ore bodies, you can get investment no matter what. But of course, we're quite mined out in some areas. Our problems, of course, are electricity supply, poor transport, and a poor regulatory environment, both in terms of content and consistency. And frankly, we need to up our game if we're going to capture more of the global investment dollar.
Yeah, I was reading a very interesting report, Isa, by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, and chatting to Martin Briggs on the show about it. Their general theme is one of an age of scarcity that we're entering into. This is over the medium to long term here. And, you know, the fact remains, yes, Warwick made mention of the fact that some of our ore bodies are pretty well mined out, in gold in particular, but in certain other metals and minerals, we're very well endowed, accessible ore bodies, yet we failed to paint a vision of how we as a country are going to exploit these. And if you look at the Fraser rankings, we've plummeted down those. What sort of story could the Mines Minister or even the President tell at this Indaba to help start turning that narrative around?
I think it's not just the mining sector alone, it's the overall economy, you know, in terms of how government is positioning for higher investment. And I would say we have to separate between the short-term headwinds and the medium to long-term trajectory. Over the short term, we do have quite a bit of headwinds that would imply that it's not a good investment investment story. But over the medium term, with what has been done from a reform progress point of view, a lot has turned in a positive direction. That's why Moody's changed the outlook from negative to stable. They are seeing those positives, and if they just continue, we will likely create a better environment for investment, and we should see some of the investments flowing into the mining sector. Given that all this renewable energy story, all this decarbonization story will continue to require metals, some of which we have locally, and we should be able to benefit out of that. But overall, I think medium term to long term, we do have a good story to tell. It's still very slow, but it is in the right direction. And if you are looking for long-term investment, direction is more important than speed. Because we all know people die at high speeds.
Well, that may be true. It would be nice to see a few ministers dying if they weren't acting at a high speed to change things around. And I reference here that Fraser Institute survey, Raymond, because if you look at it, 75th from 40th in 2019 in terms of investment attractiveness. That just isn't good enough. Surely if we were serious about this, it's all about incentives. The President should make part of the Mines Minister's KPIs moving us back up the rankings. And if you don't perform, well, then you're gone.
Well, Michael, I think the point just to add, though, that and to caution, perhaps, that it's nice to say we're in the right direction, but we're not going fast enough. The accumulation of delayed reform has now built up a huge opportunity cost, which we need to retrieve. So I'm hoping that the agenda for the Indaba will not be driven just by the problems that we know. Because in fact, if you list some of, or if you indeed just tick the boxes of the mining industry, it applies to several other sectors, whether it's electricity or transport or policy uncertainty, it's there. But as rightly said, there are some changes in the pipeline. So I'm hoping that the agenda for the Indaba will be solution driven to say, yes, look, what the world is in fact telling us, whether some people are like it or not, that what we dig out of the ground and what we grow is actually what the world wants. And we must now be able to unpack that and realize the new opportunities that shifts in the world economy may be offering us. So I'm hoping that the mining Indaba will stress the opportunities. Yes, there are short-term problems. Knock some heads together. Work together with government to say, let's expedite what you are promising to do, so that drift doesn't become the enemy of delivery. Mm-hmm. And let's look at the longer term, because what we have to dig out of the ground and grow is actually huge potential in this country. And we've now got to find a smart way to unlock it and to get the investment mobilized that will help us to unlock it. So I agree. I think we must just take an attitude about the short term of knocking heads together, making things happen, and then translate that into longer term positive prospects, which that sector deserves in particular.
And we've been doing it for 150 years. In fact, the JAC was founded in a tent on the back of the discovery of gold back in 1887. It's so integral to what we do as an economy. It's a highly, and Warwick, to bring you in here, a highly capital intensive, extremely front-loaded business with longer dated cash returns, operating within this broader uncertainty of the commodities cycles that, you know, mining companies have got to allocate capital within. So that's why policy certainty is so critical. There is extraordinary risk in digging holes in the ground. It doesn't seem like government really understands this.
Well, I'm not sure that whether they do or don't understand it, but they certainly haven't really properly taken it on board. I mean, we may be headed in the right direction, but in terms of actual new mining investments in this country, it's been virtually negligible since 2019. So I think that pretty much backs up the kind of scoring that we're seeing in the Fraser Institute. Those with money are not spending. And it's exactly the same, a different kind of reflection as opposed to our unemployment problem, that those that have the capacity to hire are not. And we need to understand that failures in policy and politics have consequences.
Yeah, and just look at the number of mining counters listed on the JSE. It's never been as few as we have now, not since 1887, back to the founding days under the tent. Let's turn now to the last talking point for the week, and that's obviously the Zondo Commission's fourth report. One more still to come, and it does, Isa, look like Zondo is sticking that dipstick deeper into the belly of accountability here. Several individuals, including former President Jacob Zuma, now being fingered. What should the next steps be here, and what should we anticipate, considering that we are seeing some movement inside the NPA as well? A significant victory this week in overturning that Transnet 1 billion rand asset freeze. Overnight we had a story that the NPA top leadership met with Eskom's top leadership to share resources to start prosecuting those fingered there. What should we be expecting as the next steps?
You know, I think what we have to really look for is successful prosecutions, that those that have been found to have been involved in corruption and benefited not correctly from state capture should be held accountable. And, you know, the hands of the law must reach every part that will be found implicated. That can give confidence to investors, to South Africans, that, you know, no leader, whether political or in business, can get away with misappropriating funds of the state or doing illegal things. I think that is what we need to see.
Rather than perpetrators tweeting happily away like Monsieur Coco is want to do. I mean, taking Zondo on review when Eskom is pursuing a claim of 3.8 billion rand civilly against these seven former executives, Malefi, Singh, Coco, Daniels, Ngubane, Mabude and Pamensky, because we need to continually name and shame these individuals who are walking around with impunity, Raymond. And I think that's what leads to this lack of confidence. So we just not see accountability.
Yes, I think apart from successful prosecutions, the message that's coming out of Zondo, of all the reports, and hopefully also in his final report, is the need for successful and accountable institutions. Look at the near miss we had with the National Treasury, which emerges from the fourth report. It was touch and go. And so the message to me is that we need to look critically at how we strengthen our institutions, whether it's in Parliament or in the private sector, or other agencies, to ensure that the checks and balances which nearly failed us under our democracy are strengthened for the future, that we take every opportunity to try and avoid this kind of thing happening again. And I believe that's one of the kernel issues that's now emerging, that we need to strengthen the institutions given the dangerous course we followed and what a near miss we've had, and how long it's taking to repair and remedy it already says that the damage was huge. But we've now been able, thanks to Zondo, to uncover not only what went wrong, but how we can get it right in future. And that comes back to effective and accountable institutions, not only in government, but also in the private sector.
Is that possible, Warwick? You're nodding your head. We've got about 30 seconds to go. Many cynically would say that's only possible with the ANC out of power.
Let me put it this way. I think that Eskom claims are going to be even tougher than Sinov claims. But in terms of both of them, it boils down to the same thing. First of all, integrity and management, and secondly, integrity and structural robustness in your institutions and processes. Simple as that.
Simple as that, folks. There you have it. That was Warwick Lucas, head of Galileo Securities, joined by Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isaac Klunger, chief economist at Alex Forbes, putting your week in perspective here on Business Watch.